Came by to see me a while back. He was worried. Stuff he mentioned didn't add up to me. I told him to watch his back and look for an exit before it was too late.
The man, Pine thought, looked deadly serious about that. Puller said,
"Okay. What exactly did he tell you?"
At that moment, the door opened and three guards and two suits entered the room.
"Interview is over,"
said one of the suits. Puller barked.
"It was fully authorized, and we're not done yet."
"You're done now,"
said the other suit. The guards grabbed startled Vincenzo and started to pull him from the room.
"Hey, hey!"
The inmate roared as he struggled futilely against them. He looked bug-eyed at Puller and screamed.
"You screwed me over, you son of a—"
And then the door slammed shut, and Teddy Vincenzo was gone. Chapter 8. "That was it?" said Carol Blum, when Pine returned to the hotel and reported what had happened at the prison. John made inquiries and ran into a stone wall. "He'll keep at it, but I don't know what the result will be." "But I don't understand. Why would anyone care that you were talking to Teddy Vincenzo?" "Maybe the people his son was involved with do. Teddy seemed to think his son was way out of his league. And these people can influence the goings-on at a prison? I mean, how would they have even known you were there?" Pine looked at her. "Apparently they have connections, at a pretty high level." "Well, that's a scary thought. And it also means we don't have a way to get a lead on Ito or Tony. So we're back at square one." Pine slumped down in a chair and looked out the window at the backs of buildings perched on the rear of the hotel property. One tiny step forward, four jumps back. "Did Teddy tell you anything that was helpful before the interview was stopped?" "He did confirm that his father was pissed about what happened to Bruno." "Did Teddy know his father was even in Georgia back at that time?" "He would have been an adult by then, so he might not have been living at home. He started getting in trouble with the law even before then. But even so, I would imagine he would know if his father was missing, particularly for an extended period. But in any case, he said he didn't remember and would have to think about it. Now I guess we won't get the opportunity to ask him again. Not unless Puller can work some magic. He didn't sound hopeful from the last email he sent." She grew silent and then said, "Vinny's Creamery." "What?" "Ito had an ice cream shop in Trenton named that. He said it was only a half mile from their house. I wonder if it's still there." "If it is, wouldn't Teddy have mentioned it?" "I didn't ask him, and they don't deliver ice cream where Teddy is." As it turned out, Vinny's Creamery was no longer there. The entire area had been razed, and an apartment building and other businesses had been put up in place of the old shops that had lined both sides of the street. Pine and Blum asked around and found Darren Castor, a middle-aged man who had worked at Vinny's and was now head of maintenance at the apartment building. Castor was about to take his coffee break, and Pine bought him a cup at a shop around the corner from the apartment building. Castor was in his 50s, had a string bean frame, a thick crown of gray hair and weathered features. He sipped his coffee as he reminisced. He grinned.
"Ito Vincenzo. Haven't heard that name in a long time."
"You liked working with him?"
"Oh yeah, it was fun. Happy customers. Who doesn't like ice cream? My job now, all I get are complaints."
"I guess so."
"We sold gelato too, of course. I mean, he was Italian after all. And desserts and bakery goods. Ito made them himself. He was really good. The business did well."
"Yeah, I understand he was a good cook." Pine took out a picture of Ito that she had gotten while in Georgia. "And just to confirm, we're talking about the same person." Castor looked at the photo and nodded.
"That's Ito, all right."
"Did you know his son, Teddy?" asked Blum.
"Bad news. He's been in and out of prison. Ito couldn't do anything with him. Kept giving him second chances, and when his back was turned, Teddy would put his hand in the till and the money would disappear. Ito never learned with that piece of trash."
"When was the last time you saw Ito?" asked Pine.
"Hell, I don't know. It was a long time ago."
"Just think about it for a bit. Work it through in your head. Tie it to major events in your life. That will help."
"Well, I started working for him when I was 18. I remember that because I was just out of high school and answered an ad Ito put in the paper. So that was back in 1985. I was there full-time through... Okay, yeah, I started at the auto body shop in, I think, 2001.
So you worked for him for over 15 years? Said Blum.
I know, ice cream, right? But it went by fast. He taught me a lot. Learned about dealing with people, which has come in handy down the road. Heck, I became his partner in a way. He treated me well. Never got rich, but I got by, and it was enjoyable work. We had a lot of regular customers. It was a popular place, packed on Fridays and the weekends, all word of mouth. His stuff was just that good.
Then I understand that Ito just disappeared one day? Asked Pine. Castor nodded, looking sad.
Yeah, that's right. It's the only reason I changed jobs. Strangest thing. One day he was there, the next, poof, the guy was gone. His wife, Evie, tried to keep the business going. She could cook, too, especially her baked goods. I helped out as much as I could, but I needed a steady paycheck. I had a family then. Competition started coming in, and people stopped eating as many sweets, and the business just kept going down. Evie ended up selling it.
Any idea what happened to him?
Nobody knows, at least that I heard of. They looked for him and all, the police, I mean. But as far as I know, no one ever saw hide nor hair of him again.
So, before he went missing, did you notice anything unusual? Was he troubled or anything? Did he get a letter or a phone call that upset him? Castor drank his coffee while he thought about her questions.
Well, first of all, I didn't know he was going to disappear, so I didn't pay particular attention to the time leading up to it.
Still, anything you can recall? He shook his head.
Not that I can recall, no. I'm sorry. It was just so long ago.
Okay. So you left there and started work at the auto body place?
That's right. I was always good with cars. Then that place went under and I got this job.
So Ito would have disappeared sometime shortly before that?
Yeah, in 2001, I'm pretty sure.
Okay. Let me ask you something else. During the spring and summer of 1989... Was Ito absent from the business? Castor finished his coffee.
1989? Woo, now you're really getting in the weeds with me, lady.
Take your time and think it through again, said Pine. And I'm not talking about a day or even a week. This would have been a chunk of time that he was gone. I'm talking months. You should be able to remember that. Realization finally spread across Castor's face.
That's right. I remember now. It must have been 1989, because I'd been there about 4 years then, and that was the only time he was gone for more than a few days. Said he was going to Italy. You know, the old country. That's what he told Evie, too. They still had kids at home, so I guess she couldn't go. He was gone for about 2 months, maybe more. And it was a busy time, too, the spring and all. Scared me to death, because I had to make all the ice cream and stuff. But Ito had taught me well. Evie stepped in and helped out. So it worked out okay. But still, I wish he hadn't left us in the lurch like that. If he hadn't come back when he did, I'm not sure he'd have had a business to come back to. If that had happened in 2001, we probably wouldn't have made it. Like I said, there was a lot more competition for customers in 2001 than in 1989, at least around here.
Yeah, I can see that, said Pine. And when he came back?
He had a bunch of stuff from Italy, all right, and everything seemed okay.
Until he disappeared?
Yep. He got back to work and ran the business, and everything was normal. Until that time he left and never came back. Damn shame. I enjoyed working for him. It was fun. What I do now, it's just a job.
Did you know his brother, Bruno?
Can't say that I did, no. I did hear about him, though. Apparently, he was some kind of criminal, like Teddy is. Maybe it ran in the family. He never came around the shop, least that I knew of. Bruno got killed in prison or something, right?
Yes. Did Ito tell you that he was a criminal?
No, Evie did. She didn't like him one bit, I can tell you that. Told me she wouldn't have that man in her house. I think she was afraid he'd rub off on Teddy. Well, that strategy didn't work. But some people are just born bad.
Did Evie have her husband declared dead at some point? Asked Blum. I think they have to wait a certain amount of time, 7 years or so.
Not that I know of, but I would have moved on long before then.
Anything else you can tell us? Focusing on when he came back, asked Pine. She leaned forward and her voice grew tense. Did he seem nervous or upset or troubled in any way? Castor scratched his head.
Not that I recall specifically, but again, it was a long time ago. He brought me back a bottle of wine from Italy and some chocolates. Never had nothing like that before.
So he just seemed the same? Asked Pine, clearly disappointed. Castor thought some more.
Well, I don't know if it means anything, but I do remember him telling me something not long after he got back.
What? Said Pine sharply.
He said, "You never know what you're capable of until you have to do it." It was such a weird thing to say that it stuck with me.
Pine glanced at Blum. Did he elaborate? Asked Blum.
Well, I asked him, did he have to do something in Italy that surprised him?
And what was his answer?
He said he hadn't done something that surprised him. He'd done something that shocked him. But he never would say what that was.
I'm sure he didn't, muttered Pine. She handed Castor her card. You've been a big help. If anything else occurs to you, give me a call or shoot me an email. Chapter 9. John Puller was not a man easily intimidated. A many times decorated soldier and 2-time Purple Heart recipient, he carried physical scars from being in a war that were harsh to look at, but he nonetheless carried them with pride. The internal trauma he endured from humans trying to kill other humans in often the most barbaric ways possible was difficult to confront. So he often chose not to. Whether that would come back to haunt him at some point, as it had others, he didn't know. But right now, he had a job to do. And right now, that job was causing Puller considerable stress, or at least the man sitting across from him was. Barney Moss was taller than Puller, but flabby, his skin a sickly white. His drab brown suit was ill-fitted, either because he'd lost weight or because he didn't give a crap about his clothes. His hairdo was a stringy, greasy comb-over. He looked like the villain in every bad 1970s-era movie ever made. His necktie was undone, and his open collar showed off his neck waddle. He was the government suit repping Fort Dix, so technically he was a fellow Fed. Yet from the moment Puller stepped into the office, Moss's manner had Puller fantasizing about pulling his gun.
So, just to be clear, you are not to ever approach Theodore Vincenzo again for any reason,
said Moss for the 3rd time now. He apparently thought repetition equated with substance.
If you do, there will be hell to pay and you'll be the one footing the bill, buddy.
He stared straight across the width of the scarred and cheap wooden desk, like it was a stretch of battlefield, and Puller was the enemy firmly engaged. Puller cleared his throat, inclined his neck slightly to the right, and was rewarded with a satisfying pop and release of vertebral pressure.
Well, now let me be as clear as I can be, Mr. Moss. I'm investigating a case, and I talk to the people I need to talk to, and Teddy Vincenzo is one of those people.
Puller kept direct eye contact with the man, searing every detail of his countenance into the part of his memory that he reserved for special people. Puller continued.
And despite your calling me and ordering me to come here, I still don't have a clue as to why you're even involved in this, since you don't happen to be in my chain of command. That also means that legally, technically, and every other way in which the United States Army does business, I have no obligation to follow any order you attempt to give me. So I'm just here as a courtesy. You might or might not be familiar with the concept.
He added,
just so we're clear.
Moss sighed and rested his palms on his paunch.
So that's how it's going to be, is it? From my perspective, it's the only way it can be. What, you need to hear from your buddies playing soldier in the sandbox?
he said with a sneer.
Will that make you feel better if it comes from a guy with pretty ribbons on his chest?
Puller's features remained inscrutable, even as he inwardly seethed at this inane insult.
I need to hear from my chain of command. It goes up to the commanding general at the U.S. Army's Criminal Investigation Command, and then tops out at the Army's Provost Marshal General. Just like you have a chain of command.
Puller cocked his head and eyed the man more closely.
So, can you tell me who ordered you to do this?
To do what?
Feed me a bunch of bullshit.
Sorry, but you're not cleared for anything else.
On the contrary, I'm cleared for everything up to TSCSI with polygraph. How about you? What are you cleared for?
Puller eyed the wall behind the man where photos and mementos were hung. They looked to be of local politicians, business leaders, a few national polls whom Puller recognized, shaking hands and grinning, and doing what elected officials are often compelled to do. He didn't even know if this was Moss's office. There had been no name on the door.
Well, that's none of your business,
said Moss, an ugly expression on his face.
For somebody with all the answers, you don't seem to have any.
Don't push me,
barked Moss.
You think you're something special because you wear a uniform?
Puller rose and looked down at the man.
I've got better things to do with my time than sit here.
Moss pointed a finger at him.
You work for the federal government. Your loyalty lies there. You follow orders. Well, here's your order. Stay away from the Vincenzos.
Puller flinched slightly.
So father and son, then?
To Puller, who was observing Moss closely, the man seemed to have regretted his words, not because of their harshness, but because of their carelessness. He composed himself and said,
You'll learn. I don't make threats lightly.
Puller closed the door quietly after him, even though his initial impulse had been to slam it.
Don't give the idiot the satisfaction.
As Puller walked outside the government building, he saw a column of dark clouds shaped like anvils creeping across the Delaware River as a storm rolled in over the water. It definitely fit his mood. Before he got to his car, he phoned Pine and filled her in on his meeting with Moss. What the hell is going on? Why is all this happening?
Teddy did mention that his son was involved in something way over his head. Maybe the people behind that got me called on the carpet with Moss.
But that would mean the folks involved in a criminal enterprise have connections to the government.
Corruption is the number one business for some politicians. Serving the country faithfully doesn't even run a close second.
Well, it's certainly plausible that Tony Vincenzo, or the people he was working with, could have connections to some powerful people.
We just have to find out who they are. Hey, how about some dinner tonight, and we can plan our next moves?
Sounds good. Puller gave her the time and place. But we need to tread lightly, Puller. It's all well and good not to be called off by a jerk like this Moss guy. But there have to be people behind him who carry a lot more clout.
It's one of the reasons I didn't shoot him. See you tonight.
Chapter 10. Pine took a shower, changed into jeans and a sweater, gunned up and slipped her badge and creds into a bag, which she slung over her shoulder. She caught her reflection in the mirror. I do look like my mother. The mother who had abandoned her. That was not a motherly thing to do. It had tainted everything that Pine felt about her. Yet she still wanted to know where her mother was, whether she was alive or dead. She drove to the restaurant, which was in a suburb of Trenton. She had looked it up online. It served Italian cuisine without breaking the budget of two federal stiffs like herself and Puller. He was already waiting in the small foyer when she got there. He was dressed in jeans, a gray V-neck sweater with a t-shirt underneath, and a windbreaker. The waiter took them to a back table, something Puller had requested. He sat with his back to the wall, which was something Pine liked to do as well. The restaurant had the usual decorations for that kind of place. Fake vines growing out of old Chianti bottles, framed prints of yachts and beachgoers on the Mediterranean hanging on the wall, red and white checkered tablecloths, and menus thick enough to be novellas. They ordered Peroni beer and opted to share a pizza with Greek salad starters. Each of their gazes had already taken in all the patrons in the place and all possible exits. It was in the DNA. It should be in everyone's DNA, Pine thought, particularly these days when any building could at any moment become a shooting gallery. I didn't ask you before, but how's your brother and your father?
Bobby's doing great, running a chunk of the country's cybersecurity now.
And your father? Puller's father was Fighting John Puller, a legendary Army 3-star with more medals than almost anyone. He was now in a VA hospital suffering from dementia.
Hanging in there,
was all Puller would say.
Just hanging in there. How's Arizona?
Hot and dry. How about you? Are you still in Virginia? Puller said.
Yeah, but I spend most days on the road.
Our jobs don't leave much time for pleasure.
No, they don't. You still doing the Olympic weightlifting and MMA tournaments?
In college, Pine had competed to be on the women's weightlifting team for the Olympics, but had missed out on a slot by a kilo. She was a black belt in multiple martial arts and had competed in MMA matches. I still lift just to stay in shape. I'm getting too old for the MMA stuff, but I can still kick over my head, she added with a grin.
I hear you.
He paused.
So I dug a little into this Moss guy, but I didn't find much. I don't think he's been in the job long.
He hasn't, was Pine's reply. He looked up at her.
You scored something?
She nodded. Called in some contacts. Up until a year ago, he was a bigwig attorney in Manhattan. Then he joined a lobbying firm. He went right from there to working for the Bureau of Prisons. He's currently the Northeast Regional Director, which puts Fort Dix under his jurisdiction. She paused. If you met the guy, didn't he tell you that? Or wasn't the title on his office door?
No and no. I don't think it was even his office. There were a bunch of photos on the wall, but he was in none of them. He's probably not based in Trenton. He was just the closest attack dog they could sic on me.
That's interesting.
It's also informative and infuriating. He obviously doesn't hold the military in high regard.
Why'd you even bother to meet with him?
I got the call and was told to meet with the guy.
Who told you to do that? She asked.
A guy 2 levels up from me at CID. He didn't seem happy about it. I think he was just grudgingly passing the request along. But his tone made it clear I had to go.
So Moss ordered you to stand down?
Which I told him he had no authority to do.
Bureau of Prisons is under DOJ.
Still not in my chain of command,
Puller replied. But DOJ can make it really hot for you.
I haven't heard any blowback yet from my side, which I take as a good sign. My folks want whoever's behind this drug ring Tony Vincenzo's involved in. Like I said, if they're selling to soldiers, it diminishes their military readiness. If soldiers are selling the drugs, it opens them up to blackmail by enemies of this country. So it ultimately strikes right at America's national security. If DOJ wants to make the argument to the DOD that something takes precedence over protecting this country, I'd love to be in the room to hear what it is.
At the end of the day, politicians do love the military, at least publicly. So you might have both right and might on your side there.
Maybe,
Puller said.
Did you find anything else about your mom and your sister?
She took a few minutes to fill him in on what she had discovered in the box in Evie Vincenzo's closet, and also her conversation with Darren Castor, the man who had worked for Ito at the ice cream shop.
So Ito did go down to Georgia, abducted your sister, and almost killed you. That seems to be confirmed, or as close as is possible at the moment.
Looks to be.
In revenge for his brother, Bruno?
It seems the case, yes.
And Ito told his employee that he was shocked by what he had done?
I don't know if that refers to almost killing a 6-year-old me or... Pine could not bring herself to say it. Or murdering my sister. Puller, obviously sensing her distress, gripped her hand and said,
One thing I've learned over the years, you have to hope for the best and plan for the worst. But it's also true that until we know everything, we really know nothing. There is no evidence that conclusively shows your sister was killed, correct?
Correct, said Pine, finally meeting his eye after twice trying and failing. She felt her adrenaline spike and tried to hide the fact that she was taking deep breaths to keep her nerves from running away from her. The last thing she wanted to show to Puller was that she was not in control. The man would be understanding, but his confidence in her would also be lessened.
Okay, then we have to proceed in the belief that she's still alive,
she said. The odds are not with that assumption, you know that.
I also know how many times the facts have proved my best assumptions wrong. There are a number of things that Ito could have done with her, and from everything you've learned about the guy, he was not a violent criminal, not like his brother. He owned an ice cream shop.
Everyone I talked to pretty much described him as being nice and kind and normal. Puller slowly let go of her hand.
It's hard to kill someone, Atlee. We both know that. It's harder still to kill a child.
Pine touched her head where Ito had struck and shattered her skull. He managed to nearly kill me.
And maybe that's what could conceivably have saved your sister. He could have killed you easily, but he hit you and then fled without knowing whether you were dead or not.
Pine slowly lowered her hand. Puller continued.
In the nursery rhyme he used, presumably to choose between you two, you asked Teddy about that to see whether it was good or bad for your sister, but his answer cut both ways.
Yes, it did.
But that could have been a guy out of his depth who's stalling for time before he has to do something he doesn't really want to do.
You're not just trying to make me feel better?
I would never do that in a situation like this. That would be crueler than anything else I could think of.
He paused and fingered his beer.
The fact is, a guy going there to do what he ultimately did, why choose at all? Why not kill both of you right then and there? He took Mercy when he didn't have to. Getting out of town with a small child, then transporting her to some other place? What could be harder than that?
Pine shook her head, looking unconvinced. He wanted to make my father suffer. He got into a fight with him, accused him of attacking his own daughter and killing the other daughter.
But I thought it was presumably your mother Bruno had the beef with, not your father.
My mother was at the hospital with me. Maybe my dad was the only one he could reach at the time.
Maybe.
And then, years later, my father, probably suffering from overwhelming guilt, took his own life on my birthday.
Damn, I didn't know that,
said Puller. I haven't told many people. He took her hand again.
I'm really, really sorry, Atlee.
Their salads and pizza came, and they ate in silence for a few minutes. They each ordered a second beer and took their time drinking it as the restaurant emptied out of customers.
You like it out there in Arizona?
Asked Puller. I like it fine.
Only fed for miles around?
No, the DEA has an office in my building. But the closest FBI agents are in Flagstaff. Then we have offices in Tucson, Lake Havasu, and of course Phoenix, among others. But for day-to-day stuff in the Grand Canyon area, it's just me.
You have any support?
I have the best admin in the bureau, Carol Blum. She's traveling with me and helping me on this. She put down her fork. So, what's our next move?
I'm running Tony down, and I haven't given up on Teddy yet either. He obviously knows stuff that's relevant, and he may know more about Ito and where he might be.
How are you going to take a run at him?
Carefully. Like you said, the DOJ can make my life miserable.
I'd like to know why any other agency even cares about this.
It only takes one bureaucrat, Atlee.
They paid their bill, splitting it down the middle despite Puller's trying to pay for it all.
It's the least I can do, Atlee.
I blew your collar. I should pay for all your meals for the next month.
You're the real deal, all right,
he said with a smile. He couldn't have paid her a higher compliment, thought Pine. They walked outside. Where are you staying? She asked.
Motel, a few miles from here. We're limited on vehicles, so Ed McElroy dropped me off and he's coming to pick me up.
I can drive you back, said Pine. Puller pointed to a green sedan with government plates parked at the curb a few feet away, with McElroy leaning against the front fender.
He's already here.
They walked over to McElroy.
How is the food?
He asked, pushing off the fender and walking toward them. Before Puller could answer, the bullet slammed into McElroy's back, dropping him right where he had stood alive and well a second before. Chapter 11. Puller and Pine crouched down behind the sedan as more rounds sailed past them. A bullet smacked into the window glass of the sedan, shattering it. Another caromed off a metal windshield support, sending bits of shrapnel spinning away. Puller and Pine drew their weapons and returned fire at the mouth of the alley from where the shots were coming. Terrified people had dropped to the pavement and were screaming. When no more shots came their way, Puller quickly checked McElroy's pulse. There was none. The man's pupils were fixed and turning glassy. His life was over.
Shit,
muttered Puller. He dialed 911 and told the dispatcher what had happened. He put the phone away and said,
You stay here with the body. I'm going after the shooter.
Not alone, you're not.
Don't argue. Someone has to stay with the body.
He peered over the hood of the car.
Cover me.
He raced across the street while Pine did so, aiming her gun toward the alley. When Puller disappeared down it, Pine snagged an older man in a private security uniform who was crouching behind a mailbox, showed him her badge, and told him to stay with the body until the police arrived. Then she raced after Puller. She hit the entrance to the alley and peered down it. The space was ill-lighted, but she could see about 50 feet ahead where Puller was crouched next to a dumpster. He looked behind him, spotted her, and frowned and pointed for her to go back. She waved this look off and pointed ahead of them into the darker recesses of the alley. Puller held up one finger and then pointed to her and then at the spot beside him. She gave a thumbs up. The alley was dark and quiet, with numerous places where someone could be waiting to ambush them, which meant they had to tread with care. When he beckoned to her, she scurried forward until she was squatting next to Puller. He snapped.
I told you to stay with the body. When I give an order, I expect it to be followed.
She barked right back. Well, in case you missed it, I'm not under your command, Puller, because I don't happen to be in the damn army. He calmed as quickly as he had angered.
Right, sorry.
She explained what she had done to protect the crime scene and McElroy's body.
Okay, I heard one set of footsteps,
he said quietly.
About 100 feet ahead. They've stopped. No door opened. No car started.
So he's still in the alley. It might be a dead end then.
Funny selection for a shooter,
Puller said ominously. Yeah, it is. Puller eyed the access ladder bolted to the brick wall and then looked up to see where it went.
I'm taking the high ground. You stay down here.
I can take care of myself, she said bluntly.
Which is why I'm leaving you alone, down here.
What are you going to do up there?
In a fight or a chase, high ground is always better ground.
He hustled over to the ladder and quickly started to scale it. Pine watched him go until he reached the roof and slipped over the edge. Pine started moving forward, in her mind's eye, trying to parallel Puller's movements above. As she left one building and moved to the next, she looked up and saw Puller leap effortlessly from that rooftop to the next. There were alleys between the buildings, but two had high chain-link fences with padlocked gates and barbed wire on top. Pine peered down a third one, but it was clearly a dead end. Three rooftops and blind or gated-off alleys later, she stopped. Her phone buzzed. It was a text from Puller. Dead end. A set of trash cans. He's behind them. Flush him. Pine edged forward and peered at the line of battered trash cans. She looked up and could see a shadow slightly darker than the night around them. It was Puller. His gun was aimed downward right at the target. Pine knelt down and pointed her pistol at the cans.
FBI, throw your weapon down and come out with your hands up, fingers interlocked behind your head. Do it! Now!
Pine could see one of the cans shaking and couldn't think of a reason why that would be. And, like Puller had pointed out before, why had this person shot McElroy from a blind alley where his escape would be cut off?
I said to come out now. Do it. This is your last warning before we open fire.
She wasn't going to open fire, because she was in no imminent danger, and Bureau rules would forbid her taking life-threatening action in such a situation. But the guy they were chasing didn't know that. She aimed her gun as the person slowly rose from behind the cover of the garbage cans. He looked like a teenager. He was black, small of frame, and he was shaking, which might explain the vibrating nature of the trash can. In his right hand was a gun. The weapon was Pine's main focus because it had to be. Once that was neutralized, she could work the situation any number of ways.
"Put the gun down," she said. "You've got no chance, so you've got no choice."
The kid looked wildly around, as though he couldn't believe he was in this situation.
"Don't shoot me,"
he cried out.
"No one's shooting anyone," said Pine. "If you put the gun down."
"I didn't do anything."
"Put the gun down and we can talk about it. You can tell me your side of things."
He shook his head.
"Nobody's gonna believe me."
"I can promise to listen if you put the gun down."
"No, lady, I can't do that. We're in deep shit."
"You'll be in a lot deeper shit if you don't put the gun down."
The kid seemed to be considering this, but was obviously unsure of what to do.
"What's your name?" asked Pine. "I like to know who I'm dealing with, that's all."
My name's Jerome. Jerome Blake."
"Okay, I'm Agent Pine." "That's a good start, Jerome. Now if you put the gun down, I can listen to your side of things." Jerome started to tremble and tears slid down his face.
"You don't understand, lady."
"I'm trying to."
He waggled his gun hand.
"Please, I..."
That was when the shot rang out. Pine cried out,
"No!"
Jerome looked over at her as though surprised by the hole that had suddenly appeared in his chest, directly over his heart. She looked up at the roof of the building. She couldn't see Puller up there, but there was no way his position would have allowed for a shot like that. She looked back at Blake in time to see him topple first into the trash cans and then to the dirty asphalt. The next moment, a uniformed policeman raced past Pine, his gun drawn. He was in his mid-40s, tall and broad-shouldered with dark hair and darker eyebrows. He knelt next to Jerome and felt for a pulse. He looked at Pine and shook his head.
"He's gone. He was gonna shoot you, ma'am."
"No, at least I didn't think he was." The cop pointed his gun over at the building as Puller scrambled down a ladder there.
"Hold it right there,"
barked the cop.
"He's with me," cried out Pine. "I'm FBI, he's Army CID.
"Let me see some ID,
said the cop in an edgy tone.
"Now."
He looked at their creds and badges and then handed them back.
"We got a 911 about shots fired and somebody being down. Guy back on the street."
"That was us," said Pine.
"Who's the dead guy on the street back there?"
Puller said.
"An Army CID agent named Ed McElroy." "Why the hell would a kid be targeting an Army CID guy?"
asked the cop.
"Wish I had the answer to that,"
replied Puller grimly.
"But I plan to find one."
Chapter 12.
"Well, thank God you weren't hurt," said Carol Blum.
She was sitting in Pine's room and had just finished listening to her account of the evening's adventures. Pine had taken off her jacket and flung it on her bed. She was sitting next to it, her gaze downcast. "But two people did die tonight. One of them an army cop, and the other was what looked to be a 16-year-old kid."
"I wouldn't exactly call him a kid if he had a gun and shot someone intentionally. But why would he target McElroy?"
"Or was he actually aiming at me or Puller? Right before he shot, McElroy stepped forward in front of us."
"I suppose that could be possible. You are investigating a case that might make some people nervous. And the shooter might be connected to Tony Vincenzo and his drug ring."
"The kid was scared, Carol. And something just felt off about the whole thing."
"I suppose the local cops are handling the situation?"
"Yes, but Puller's involved too, because the victim was one of his agents."
"What did Blake say to you?"
"That he was in deep shit, that no one would believe him."
"Believe what? He never got a chance to tell me."
She shook her head. "But there was something in his features. I don't know. It just didn't fit with the situation.
It was like he had no idea why he was even there, or how to even hold a gun. What do you plan to do about it? Blake probably has family around here somewhere. Maybe we can talk to them. But I'm sure the locals will be doing that. Won't you be encroaching on their investigation? Probably, conceded Pine. And I can't see how what took place tonight is connected to our search for what happened to your sister. I can't see that it is either, admitted Pine, gazing determinedly at her. But I also know that look, said Blum. That kid died violently right in front of me, Carol. I know stuff like that happens every day, pretty much all over this country. And it's not the first time it's happened to me. But again, something just feels off, and I'd like to know why. But you let a series of murders in Andersonville interfere with your search for your sister. And I helped solve them, and at the same time learned a hell of a lot about what happened to her. I can multitask, Carol. You should know that better than anyone. But still. Carol, the only reason I'm an FBI agent is because I want to see people who destroy other people's lives brought to justice and pay for what they did. I want the families of their victims to have closure. I want... Pine's voice trailed off, and she slumped over and stared at the floor. Blum said gently, You mean you want for others what you never got for yourself? Pine let out a long breath and said, I can't let this go. I can't. Well, as you said, we can find out who his family is and go ask questions. Dobbs would have a stroke if he knew I was getting involved in another murder case. He wants me back ASAP. Well, Clint Dobbs will just have to wait. I don't like putting you in situations like this, Carol. You work at the Bureau, too. I chose to come on this mission with you. I put myself into every situation we've faced so far, and I'm fully prepared to continue doing so. You're going way above and beyond the call of duty. You're not just my boss. You're my friend, Agent Pine. I wish you'd just call me Atlee. I've been at the Bureau too long. Protocols like that are hammered into me. How will you go about finding any relatives of Jerome Blake? Well, I can call Superman. Superman? John Puller. Didn't I tell you? He's able to leap tall buildings in a single bound. Chapter 13. The following afternoon, they set out to visit Jerome Blake's mother. She lived in an old part of Trenton that was being gentrified. They saw this in numerous homes being remodeled and expensive late-model cars parked in the driveways of some of the newly renovated homes. It's good to see old neighborhoods getting new life, said Blum. But the downside is the people who've lived here a long time get pushed out because their taxes go up, or the home prices get out of control and a working-class family can't afford to buy. Nothing fair about that, said Pine. Despite the cold, a group of young men played pickup basketball on a cracked asphalt court, pouring in three-pointers and slamming dunks through a rim with no net. As Pine and Blum passed by, some of the men stopped to watch them, their expressions not exactly friendly. Blum said, It's the next house on the left. Pine pulled into the driveway of a one-story bungalow with a metal carport, under which was parked a Buick two-door. A pair of flower pots were on the stoop. In the distance, they could hear a dog barking. So, how come Superman didn't come with us? Asked Blum. I'd like to meet the Man of Steel. You will, Carol. But the fact is, he's got a ton on his plate right now and superiors to answer to. I can only imagine the debriefings and paperwork John is having to do right now. What with losing an agent like that. But I told him what I plan to do, and I'll report back to him what we find. Pine noted that the house had a fresh coat of paint and what looked like a fairly new shingled roof. The colorful curtains in the windows were warm and inviting. They got out and walked up the sidewalk to the front stoop. Before they could knock, the door opened, and a black woman in her 40s stared back at them. She looked over her shoulders and said brusquely, Come on in. Before she stepped through the opening, Pine looked back and saw a small knot of young men gathering outside on the street in front of the house. Are those friends of Jerome's? Asked Pine.
Just come on in, said the woman. After they did, she closed the door firmly behind them and locked it. She settled them in the front living room, where the large picture window overlooked the street. Pine kept one eye there and observed that the young men were coming closer. You're Mrs. Blake, began Blum. The woman nodded, her expression both grief-stricken and nerve-wracked. Cheryl Blake, just call me Cece. Everybody does. We're very sorry about Jerome, said Pine. On the phone, you told me that you were there, Blake said, her voice cracking. When it happened. She pulled a tissue from her pocket and dabbed at her eyes, which were red and angry-looking. She had on a long sweatshirt and black running tights and tennis shoes with ankle socks. She was about 5'4", with a strong, athletic build. Muscles in her neck flexed and receded as she spoke. Pine said, Yes, I was there. I tried to talk him into putting his gun down.
But you wasn't the one to shoot him?
No, that was a local police officer. But another man was killed, an army investigator. I'm trying to understand what, if any, connection Jerome had to that.
The police came by late last night to let me know about Jerome and to ask questions, and they came by again this morning. They took stuff from his room.
Do you have other children? Asked Blum.
Two. My oldest, Willie. He's on his own now, living and working in Delaware. And then I got Jewel. She's in middle school, only 14. She's upstairs sleeping. Cried her eyes out all night. She loved her brother.
I'm sure she did, said Blum. Pine interjected. Jerome had a gun last night. A Glock. Have you ever seen that weapon around here?
Cops asked the same thing, and I'll tell you what I told them. Jerome didn't have no gun. He never wanted a gun, and he didn't have one,
she added fiercely. Well, he had one last night. I'm just trying to piece things together. Blake eyed her suspiciously.
You say you're with the government? You got something that says that?
Pine pulled out her cred pack and badge and showed them to Blake. I'm with the FBI. I was meeting with another army investigator when the shooting happened. We're working the case together.
What you want me to tell you?
What did you tell the police?
The truth. But they don't want to believe it.
I'd like to hear it, said Pine. Blake settled back in her chair and rubbed her eyes and blew her nose into the tissue. Then her softened features turned hard, and her expression became fierce.
Look, I'm not stupid, okay? I know the police come here and think, okay, here we damn well go again, same old shit. Black man kills a white man, so he got what he deserved. But see, the picture here is different, way different.
Tell me, said Pine.
For starters, Jerome was smart, real smart. The smart that you're born with, and then you get smarter by sucking up all the information you can. He got straight A's in school. He was going to college, already getting scholarship offers, and he's still a junior, because of his brain, she added sharply.
Okay, said Pine. Keep going.
Now the police came here and start telling me what happened last night is because Jerome was doing some gang thing. Kill someone. Kill a fed, they said. Initiation shit.
They actually said that to you? Asked Pine incredulously.
Sure as I'm sitting here talking to you.
And you didn't believe that, said Blum.
Course I didn't, because it isn't true. There are gangs all over this damn place. Everybody knows that. Look out the window. They're out there right now. My oldest boy. He was in a gang. But he got out. Only reason Willie moved away. Hell, I made him go. I don't want that for my kids. Too many getting shot and buried before they're even grown. My husband's dead now 14 years. He was just coming home from the grocery store with ice cream for me, because I was pregnant with Jewel and I needed something cold. He went out for damn ice cream and ended up in a box just because he was walking down the street late at night with a brown paper bag and some cops driving by had a problem with that. They said he resisted arrest, that he was going for one of their guns, and they shot him. Yeah, he was going for their guns, all right. Bullshit.
Was there an investigation?
Oh, yeah. Took all of like a week. Justifiable shooting, they said. Feared for their damn lives. Even though it was 4-1. Those cops went right back to work. They might still be out there for all I know, shooting people for carrying damn ice cream. I'm so sorry to hear that. But Jerome never wanted no part of any of that. He was home every night doing his schoolwork. He was on the honor roll. He wanted to be, what you call it when he graduated, you know, number one.
Valedictorian, suggested Blum.
Yeah, valedictorian. And he was gonna be sure as I'm sitting here. So he didn't have time for gangs. They got a robotics team at the school. Jerome was head of the whole damn thing. They won the state competition last year.
That's all very impressive, said Pine. But it doesn't account for him being in an alley across from where a man was shot, or him running from the scene with a gun. That's what I want to work through. How was he when he came home from school yesterday? Did he seem troubled or anything? Blake nodded her head.
He came home looking all upset and worried. I asked him what was wrong. He said, Mama, I messed up on a test. Missed a couple questions. I told him that ain't the end of the world. He looked at me funny like maybe it was.
She pulled a fresh tissue from her pocket, dabbed at her eyes, and looked down, shaking her head.
I can't believe this is happening. I can't believe my baby's gone. Not Jerome.
She started to rock and moan.
Lord, help me, not Jerome.
Mama? They all turned to see a tall, athletic girl around 14 at the bottom of the stairs. She was dressed in a set of two-piece pajamas, and her eyes were red from crying.
Mama, please don't cry.
Blake jumped up and wiped her eyes.
Oh, baby. Mama's okay. Just blubbering a little bit.
She turned to Pine.
This is Jewel. Jewel, these ladies are with the FBI. They're here to help find out what happened to your brother.
Jewel looked at Pine and Blum, turned and fled back upstairs. Blake watched her go, her lips trembling.
Poor baby. Poor baby. Our lives just turned upside down. I didn't let her go to school today, of course.
She shook her head.
I don't know when I'll send her back. I don't want to let her out of my sight.
Blum rose and put her hand on her shoulder and gently rubbed it.
This is every mother's worst nightmare, said Blum. I am so sorry.
Blake sniffled and said,
You got kids?
Yes, all grown. Some with children of their own and their own problems. Some I can help with, some I can't. So I just worry. You never stop being a parent, not until you take your last breath.
That's the truth, honey. That is the truth.
She patted Blum's hand and composed herself while Blum retook her seat. When did he leave the house yesterday? Asked Pine after a few moments of silence.
After dinner. He told me he got to run back to school to work on a robot. It's just down the street from here. He said the principal said it was okay. I don't like him being out at night around here. But Jewel was feeling sick and I was taking care of her, so I just told him to call me when he got there and call me when he was leaving. But I was still worried about him.
So he had a cell phone? Asked Pine.
Oh, yeah. He bought it himself. Worked for a company over the summer building gadgets and such.
No cell phone was found on him, said Pine. Did he call you last night? Blake's eyes filled with tears and she shook her head.
He texted me around 7. Say, Mama, I'm at the school. And he'd let me know when he was coming home. When he wasn't back by 10, I texted him. Then I called. No answer. I was starting to get real worried. I was gonna go looking for him. Then the police showed up to tell me my baby boy was dead.
She jumped up and hurried into the adjacent room where they could hear her sobbing. Blum rose and said, I'll see if she has any tea or coffee and make her a cup. Give me a few minutes alone with her. Pine nodded as Blum walked into the other room. Pine went over to the window and looked out. The young men had now surrounded her car and were showing it uncomfortable interest. She walked out the front door to face them. Chapter 14. "Can I help you?" asked Pine as she stood on the front sidewalk staring at the group. To a person, they all stared back at her. The oldest looked to be early 20s, the youngest 14 or so. It was 1:30 in the afternoon, so Pine wondered why the school-aged among them were not where they should have been. She could read in their eyes and attitudes one very clear reality. They didn't trust anyone who wore a badge. She asked her question again. None of them answered her. Again, they just stared. She took a few steps forward, acutely aware of the delicacy of the situation. She didn't move her hand close to her Glock, though it was visible to all of them, as was the shiny FBI shield that she had pinned to her belt. Pine knew it was not impenetrable protection. Not here. Maybe nowhere anymore. "Did any of you know Jerome Blake?"
"He's dead. Cops shot him."
This came from a boy in the back, around 15, hair cut near to the scalp, wiry build, features hardened beyond his years. But not for a place like this. For a place like this, he was probably just right. She said, "Jerome had a gun. He might have shot someone."
"Jerome didn't shoot nobody."
This came from the oldest looking of the group. "Okay. Tell me why you think that."
"Who the hell are you anyway?"
said the man. "I'm a federal cop, and I was there when the man was shot and Jerome was killed. Now I'm looking into it."
"You kill him?"
said the man, with menace in his tone and tensed features. The rest of the group, taking their vibe from him, assumed that same angry posture. Pine could sense the mob mentality emerging just enough to make her situation grow increasingly untenable. Pine said calmly, "No, I was trying to talk him into dropping the gun. Because he had a gun. I saw it. I'm not saying he did anything with it, but he had it. A Glock. His mother says Jerome never had a gun."
"She's right about that. Robot man ain't never had no gun."
The rest of the group chortled at this remark. Pine nodded. "Right. He built robots. He was smart. He said he was going back to school last night to work on robots. Only that apparently didn't happen. I'd like to understand what did happen. Did any of you see anything? Do you know where he might have gotten the gun?"
"Cops already got their story. They ain't looking nowhere else."
"Gang initiation, you mean," said Pine. "Jerome's mother told me that's what the police said. You apparently don't believe that." In a scoffing tone, the man said,
"'Cause it's not true. Jerome ain't in no gang."
"But was a gang trying to get him to join?"
"Why would they?"
said the man.
"They got all the meat they need, and you got to look at things smart."
"How do you mean?"
"Jerome was strong up here,"
said the man, pointing to his head.
"But with books and robots and shit like that. Thing is, gang's got all sorts of smarts they need. Jerome ain't smart that way, not street way. So what they want is muscle, someone who's tough and don't give a shit, and brother's willing to carry a gun and do what needs doing with it. That's not Jerome. No gang would want him. To them, he's just a book punk they got no use for."
He grinned and added,
"Shit, be like hiring Bill Gates to guard their stash. See what I mean?"
"Okay. Anything else you can tell me? Did any of you see Jerome last night? Did he text or phone any of you saying what he was going to do?" The people in the group looked at one another. Finally, the youngest of them took a hesitant step forward.
"He texted me last night."
"What time? And what did he say?" The boy pulled out his phone.
7:10. He said he got something to do, but he didn't want to do it."
"Did he say what that was?"
"No. I texted him back and asked him, but he said he can't tell me. But he said he was worried because it might go all bad."
"That what might go all bad?"
"He didn't say."
She looked at the others. "No one else saw Jerome last night or talked to him." No one said anything in response, though Pine did focus for a moment on a guy around 16 who stood off to the side. He had been staring at her, but then glanced down when she'd asked her question. "Anybody have the name of someone I should talk to about this?
A friend of Jerome's? Someone he might have confided in? Again, no one said anything. Well, thanks for the information, she said.
Now what you gonna do with it?
Snapped the man. Follow it to the truth. If Jerome did nothing wrong, then I'll clear his name, for what that's worth.
Sure you will,
said the man sarcastically.
Cops are cops. All stick together.
I'm more of a loner. I'm actually stationed out in Arizona. I'm usually the only cop around there. I go my own way and sometimes, for better or worse, make my own rules.
What you doing here, then?
Looking for answers. She eyed him. Story of my life. As she turned and headed back to the house, the man called out,
Hey, good luck, Arizona.
She looked back at him. I'll take all the luck I can get. Chapter 15. When Pine returned to the house, Blum and Blake were sitting in the front room, and Blake was sipping on a cup of tea. Blum eyed Pine curiously. I was just having a chat with some of Jerome's acquaintances, she explained as she sat down. They don't think he was involved in any gang thing either. Blake bristled. That 'cause he wasn't, like I told you. But the police don't see it that way. I told them Jerome was top of his class, that he was going to college. They looked at me like I was speaking Chinese. That must have made you very upset, said Blum. Damn right it did. But they just gonna sweep it under the rug. You mark my words. Not if I have anything to say about it, said Pine. Blake looked at her squarely. What you gonna do about it? Your boss say back off, then you gonna back off, right? Wrong, Blum answered for her. That is not how Agent Pine operates. And she is not part of the local police. She will see this through. Pine said, Is there anything else you can tell us? Did Jerome ever mention someone named Tony Vincenzo? Blake shook her head. Never heard that name. He Mexican? Italian-American. No, nobody with that name lives around here, least that I know of. And Jerome never mentioned him to me.
Until yesterday. Did Jerome seem okay?
Yeah, he went off to school all happy and everything.
But when he got home, he was upset. And you don't think it was about missing questions on a test?
I know it wasn't that.
So whatever made him do what he did last night, it happened between the time he left here yesterday morning and when he came home?
Must have been, agreed Blake.
Pine looked at Blum. So we need to find out what that was.
Do we go to his school then?
Asked Blum. It's a start. The high school was about a half mile from where the Blakes lived. A new football field had been erected, and the facade of the building had been power washed, and a new adjacent building was set off from the main building. The landscaping looked abundant and well planned out. She hoped the classroom, students, and teachers had gotten the same level of support. They headed to the main office, and Pine's badge got them in to see the principal. Her name was Norma Bailey. She was a tall black woman with iron gray hair pulled back in a severe bun. She had the no-nonsense manner of someone long used to having to corral and attempt to control, and finally to teach, legions of teenagers.
I heard about poor Jerome, she began, her expression full of sadness. I wish I could say I can't believe it, but shootings have become so frequent. People just see one on the news and the next day there's another. People are becoming desensitized to the whole thing, and that is an abysmal development.
But you would be surprised it would involve Jerome, said Pine.
Yes, I'm afraid I wasn't clear on that point. Jerome.
She shook her head and touched her trembling lips with a shaky hand before regaining her composure.
He was one of the brightest students we had. He was destined for an important role in life. He would have gone very far. He was an absolute genius in math and science. He could understand things even the teachers couldn't. And we have two math PhDs here. A certifiable prodigy.
We understand he was the head of the robotics team, said Blum.
Yes. That's housed in the new building on the school grounds, They won the state last year. It was very exciting. Jerome, he loved his robots, that was clear. He could build them with such flair.
She dabbed at her eyes with her fingers and said,
"How can I help you?"
We've learned from Jerome's mother that he was fine when he went to school yesterday, but he wasn't when he got home. He mentioned something about a test and that he had missed some questions.
No, that couldn't be. There were no tests in any class yesterday. It was a prep day for upcoming exams.
Okay. Then he wasn't truthful with his mother. Something else was bothering him. And from the timeline, it seems that it happened while he was at school.
I can't imagine what that might have been.
Can we speak with his teachers? Asked Pine.
Certainly, I can arrange that.
Have the police been in to talk to you? Asked Blum.
No, they haven't been by.
Pine and Blum exchanged a troubled look. An hour later, they had spoken with all of Jerome's teachers. None of them could recall anything that might have led Jerome to do what he allegedly had. They all expressed shock and sorrow, but provided no useful information. As they left the school, Pine glanced to her right.
I know him.
He was outside the Blake's house this morning. The person Pine was referring to was sitting on the fence surrounding the new football field. Pine and Blum walked over to him. Pine said,
You looked like you knew something but didn't want to say earlier.
The young man jumped down and faced them. He was about Pine's height, lean, and looked as tough as a piece of iron. His face held a jagged scar, and part of one of his fingers was missing.
Did you know Jerome?
Yeah.
What's your name?
He shrugged. You followed us here, didn't you? So you must have something to tell us. He looked over her shoulder. We think Jerome met someone yesterday who made him do whatever he did last night. Do you know anything about that?
Maybe.
Maybe you do, prompted Pine.
See a man talking to him yesterday.
Here at the school? He nodded. Do you go here? Asked Pine. He shook his head.
And go to school.
You graduated? Asked Blum. He shrugged, grinned, and said nothing. Did you recognize the man he was talking to?
Uh-uh.
What time of day was it?
About 2.
He pointed.
Saw him talking over there.
What did the man look like?
White dude. Tall guy with big shoulders.
Age?
40s, maybe. Dark hair.
How was he dressed?
Pants and a shirt.
Tie? He shook his head. You think he worked here?
Don't know.
If we can get some pictures together, do you think you could recognize him again?
Maybe.
What's your name? She asked again.
Peanut, what they call me on the street.
How well did you know Jerome?
We real tight till a while back.
What happened?
I quit going to school and he didn't.
Pine said, How did Jerome seem when he and the man parted company?
Jerome, he walked off, looking at his shoes. Seemed jumpy to me. Weird, you know?
Do you think Jerome would have shot anyone? He cracked a smile.
Shit, lady. Jerome don't know how to kill nobody.
Chapter 16. They had gone back into the school and asked Norma Bailey if she could put together a photo book and background information of the school employees. She told them that they had it digitally, but it would take her some time to get the necessary permissions to release that information. She added that she would contact Pine when it was ready. After that, they climbed into their car and drove off. 3 minutes later, Pine said quietly, We picked up a tail. Silver Mercury Marquis. Don't look, Carol. Blum caught herself halfway through turning around. Sorry, Agent Pine. Can you tell who it might be? Pine slowed down a bit to let the car catch up, and she eyed it through the rearview mirror. Okay, now I can make out the plate. It looks like a New Jersey state plate. Can you make out the tag number? Yes. Write it down. Pine told her the plate number, and Blum inputted it on her phone.